First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
This is WJCT News 89.9 in Jacksonville. Opinions expressed on the Friday Media Roundtable are those of our panelists and do not necessarily reflect the views of WJCT News.
A May runoff is set in the city's mayor's race. A local lawmaker is pushing a bill to crack down on drag shows. And Florida looks to a major expansion of school vouchers. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We're live with you from Studio 2. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the week's top stories with our Friday roundtable. You can join us at 549-2937. Then later, a conversation with Mark Weiss, the man behind some of the most iconic rock star photos in the modern era. We'll tell you about his new exhibit in this region. But first, it's Friday. And here to round up all the week's news, we welcome Will Brown of our own Jacksonville Today. Hey, Will.
Good morning.
Joe McClain from our partner News for Jax.
Good morning. Thank you.
Jax Today contributor Nikisha Williams.
Good morning.
And A.G. Gankarski of Jax Today.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to have you all. You can listen live on the radio or watch the video stream of our fabulous panel of pundits. They're up on TV right now on Facebook and YouTube. And it's 549-2937.
Sit up straight.
Right?
Yeah, sit up straight. P's and Q's. 549-2937. Let's begin with our top story. Republican Daniel Davis and Democrat Donna Deegan are headed to a runoff election to determine who will be this city's next mayor. Deegan is the first woman to advance this far in holding the city's top post. Jacksonville has never had a female mayor. Deegan got 39% of the vote in Tuesday's election. Davis closed the night out with 25%. Now, the winner will replace Mayor Lenny Curry. He is termed out. At the same time, two incumbent at-large members on the city council are going back to City Hall. Republican Ron Salem beat Democrat Joshua Hicks 53-47%. Republican Terrence Freeman beat out Libertarian Eric Parker at 65% of the vote. And a third race goes to a May runoff. The two top vote getters are Republican Chris Miller and Democrat Charles Garrison. We'll talk about some other races, too, but let's begin with the mayor's race as it heads to a May runoff. Of course, if we had ranked choice voting in this city, as some cities in America have started to adopt, there wouldn't be a runoff and it would save the city a lot of money. We don't have that, though. So you all have to go out and vote again. Give us a call at 549-2937 with your thoughts about who will get your vote for mayor. 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Facebook always open. Will Brown, let's begin with you. This is a classic face-off between a very conservative Republican in Daniel Davis and Donna Deegan, one of the city's most visible and well-known Democrats. A lot of this is going to come down to turnout and fundraising between these two powerhouse candidates.
The thing that I just cannot get out of my mind is how few people showed up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I see DD, whether it's Donna Deegan or Daniel Davis, I used to think of Double Dare, the show back in the day. But, you know, now I double dare folks to go vote. I mean, we had 25% turnout. So, I mean, whether it was Deegan, whether it was Davis, I mean, combined, you know, 38 plus 25 is about 63. So 63% of the 25% turnout. So that's about 18 to 20% of the voting populace decided the two finalists for mayor. That's not good enough.
No, it's really abysmal. 549-2937. Maybe we can at least get some participation in civics on the phone lines. Joe McClain, you know, did the negative ads between... in particular, Daniel Davis and Leanna Cumber, did that depress turnout?
I, not being a real big political expert myself, I can only speculate. But who I did talk to was Jerry Holland, who is the outgoing property appraiser, and he's going to be again the supervisor of elections leading up to 2024. And he was the supervisor of elections for like 10 years. I spoke to him at Leanna Cumber's election night watch party. And he said, in his experience, that sort of thing does depress turnout, because what it does is it, while it doesn't build up your candidacy, it does, it's meant to tear away votes from the other person. So the really, you know, very visceral slug match that was happening between particularly, not exclusively, but particularly Leanna Cumber and Daniel Davis's campaign. I mean, we saw those TV ads that just got really, really accusatory, and you know, there was a lawsuit that came out of a couple of them. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, according to Jerry Holland, according to people that I talked to really at Cumber's party, maybe it didn't depress turnout for them, but what it did do was sour the Cumber supporters from supporting, many of them from supporting Daniel Davis now. In fact, when I was talking to folks about where their support is going to go at Cumber's party, some of them said they didn't know. Some of them said they're not really going to support anybody, and they're not going to check a name for mayor. And some of them said, I'm going to support Donna Deegan. I'm going to cross party lines and support Donna Deegan. Because what they were saying was they're prioritizing change in the mayor's office than party loyalty, which is interesting.
That's the message we can expect to hear from the Deegan campaign, that the city needs change, that we need to turn the page on what many perceive to be a corrupt little cabal of insiders that have run this town for a long time and have shut the average Joe out of the process. Davis is going to talk about conservative values in this campaign. In fact, he already has. He's aligned himself with national culture war issues in his victory speech. He'll talk about his endorsements from JSO and things like that, Nikisha. But, you know, it's just incredible how much money has already been spent. Leanna Cumber spent millions of dollars and got a pretty poor result. Her colleague on the city council, Al Ferraro, basically didn't have $2 bills to rub together, and he wildly overperformed. Davis spent millions and was only able to garner about 25% of the vote. He's going to have to re-raise all that money. Of course, for Donna Deegan, a lot of observers of this race think for her to even have a chance, she's going to have to get a big cash infusion from the National Democratic Party. What are your thoughts?
I don't know if Donna's necessarily going to need a huge war chest in this race. And the reason I say that is because she is a well-known figure in this community. Everybody knows that name. And then I did like some of the personal touches she had in the community. Like, she had people going door to door. They knocked on my door, handed me a flyer. I was like, oh, this is different. And so it's that, like, that grassroots kind of campaigning that she did that had a personal touch and I think ingratiated her more to voters. But my biggest concern, I think, in terms of the May runoff, when you talk about national campaigns and Davis aligning himself with culture war issues, and I believe Jack Webb said this one time when we were on the panel together, is that it's not going to be Donna Deegan versus Daniel Davis. It's going to be Donna Deegan versus Ron DeSantis, because as we know, the governor is in Jacksonville a lot.
He was here yesterday.
Exactly. He was here yesterday. And not only is he here a lot, he's been very strategic in making sure that Duval returns red, as it didn't do in the 2020 presidential election, but it did in the election
for midterms.
So he's going to be here. He's going to throw his support behind Daniel Davis. And that is going to be another culture war fight, mm-hmm. and one that Donna is going to have to prepare for and figure out how to maneuver and strategize and continue to be the adult in the room, to borrow from Michelle Obama. Because when they go low, what is she going to respond with? Is it going to be high, or is it going to be down in the dirt like Leanna Cumber tried to do, which was ineffective?
AG Gankarski, I think that's a fair prediction that we might see the governor weigh in with an endorsement in this race. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely expect DeSantis to endorse if Donald Trump does not endorse Daniel Davis first. I think given the DeSantis-Trump war, the endorsements would be mutually exclusive. You know, one thing I'm watching, you know, this, I had a conversation with Audrey Gibson yesterday, who was eliminated from the mayoral race, of course. And Audrey Gibson was not happy with Donna Deegan. She refused to endorse her. She questioned Donna Deegan's ability to drive turnout in black precincts. If you look at precinct data from this election, that bears it out, because the lowest performing precincts were Democratic dominated precincts. That's one of the reasons that Deegan was below 40%. And Gibson said she was disgusted with the tone of the campaign, disgusted with the implication that she was running to, you know, sort of block Deegan from winning outright in March, which wouldn't have happened anyway. If you took all of Gibson's vote, gave it to Deegan, she still would have been below 50%. But I think the lack of party unity among Democrats is something that we've sort of ignored, given, you know, the concentration on negative advertising for months and months between, you know, Cumber and Davis. I think Donna Deegan's got more serious problems than the panel's acknowledged so far. And it's not just money and it's not just Ron DeSantis. It's about making that play and getting turnout up in these communities that didn't turn out last time. I don't know how to get Audrey Gibson back on board. Wednesday, I said, you know, reach out to, you know, I suggested to Gibson, Deegan reach out to Gibson, Ferrero, Cumber, sort of do a team of rivals thing. I don't think Gibson's on board for that at this point. And, you know, that raises serious questions to me. So, yeah, Ron DeSantis is going to engage if Donald Trump does not. But the real thing to watch here is, you know, can Donna Deegan actually drive turnout in the African-American dominated, Democratic dominated precincts that were laggards in turnout on Tuesday?
I think those are all good points. At the same time, I have to tell you that we did reach out to the Deegan campaign after your piece ran with Audrey Gibson's comments. The Deegan campaign told WJCT News that many of her remarks were complete fabrications. They said that she lied in your piece and that you never contacted the Deegan campaign to confirm the accuracy of some of Gibson's remarks about Donna Deegan. So that's important to note. Let's go
well,
to some
of that.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, but at the same time, I mean, it does speak to the fact that if you're saying that, not you personally, but the Deegan campaign is saying that Gibson's lived experience is a lie.
No, that's not what they said. They said that the accusations that Audrey Gibson made against Donna Deegan are simply not true. That some of the quotes you attributed to Audrey Gibson, that comments she claimed Donna Deegan made to her, they call those a complete fabrication. And they expressed disappointment at WJCT News that you never called her campaign to confirm whether those conversations took place.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's still, the point remains that Audrey Gibson's not on board.
That's
and
right.
I don't think if Deegan shooting down that piece is going to help. I mean, as a winning candidate, as a winning Democratic candidate, it's incumbent on her to actually unify the party. And this is just a real challenge.
Well, let's go to some calls now at 549-2937, Kathy in Fairfax. Go ahead, Kathy.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. This is a fascinating conversation. So I have a couple of comments. One is that I think that listeners ought to go online and look at both of the candidates and what they're saying on their, you know, their websites, what they're, you know, what they're standing for. With Dan Davis, it seems like pretty much status quo. You know, let's continue to focus on crime as being the biggest issue in the city, which I don't think is a priority for, you know, the majority of the citizens of Jacksonville. If you look at Donna Deegan's, she has a lot more specific policy recommendations, things that she'd actually, you know, try to get accomplished in the city. Infrastructure is a problem. There's plenty of neighborhoods suffering because of lack of infrastructure investment. The other thing that I wanted to comment about was this thing about DeSantis and the culture war, or, you know, stuff. Overwhelmingly, people in Jacksonville care about things like quality public education and women's rights, and, you know, specifically reproductive rights. And so I think, you know, getting young people especially, you know, getting them voting on these issues that absolutely affect them would be a priority.
All right.
Thank you for taking my comments.
Thank you. Will Brown.
You know, I read that piece that AG wrote about Audrey Gibson's thoughts, and the thing that I just couldn't keep out of my mind was black women have been the backbone of the Democratic Party for God knows how long. I mean, it's like a backbone. If the Democratic Party could not stand up without black women, and I'm not the smartest cookie in the shed, but, you know, someone who has been in elected office for two decades and has a history of bringing home the dollars to Duval, something Republicans and Democrats will acknowledge, definitely had the right to run for mayor. Mm-hmm. Did she win? Clearly not. But
I mean,
yeah, but clearly she was upset with some of the commentary about her campaign. I think that's fair to say.
Right. Yeah. But, I mean, was she going to win? Who knows? I mean, that was a tough hill to climb. But the idea that anyone would say that someone of Audrey Gibson's pedigree, caliber, and character shouldn't have run for mayor is ridiculous.
Okay. But it's not just that about her running for mayor, and it's not just, you know, the mischaracterization that was in the piece, whatever the gripes were. I think the bigger issue and the bigger reason why Audrey Gibson may not have supported Donna Deegan or is still not ready to unify the party is that there is sometimes the assumption by progressive white candidates that they will automatically have the support of the black community and that black women will do their labor and get other black voters on board and gather that support and rally them and make them show up to the polls. I was at WJCT right before the election doing a panel and an event where I gave a keynote speech from the Democratic Women's Information Network. Everybody in that room was black for the most part, and most of the people in that room were black women. So if they didn't go out to vote or if they didn't support Deegan's candidacy, it's not incumbent upon Audrey Gibson to say, well, let me go out for you and unify the party. What are you doing to unify the party?
Well, I hate to cut everyone off, but it looks like Donna Deegan is on the line.
Hey, girl.
Donna Deegan, good morning.
Good morning, guys. Yeah, Melissa, I actually sent you a statement this morning, which I guess just never made it to you. I really desperately want to, you know, just say that I'm disconcerted that this is being painted in a way that it is. But I just want to say this, for whatever it's worth to anybody who's listening, you know, I got into this race, into this arena in total, largely because of black women. The fact that they reached out and prayed for me and encircled me when I was going through my own sickness, and the fact that I have for 20 years with the foundation watched them in a disproportionate way die because of lack of access. So if you look at the pillars of my campaign, they are very strongly hewed toward the broken promises of consolidation. If you look at what I've done in this campaign, as Nikisha said earlier, I have spent a lot of time in the black community, and I'm not just showing up there. I've been there for my whole life because of what I've done for a living and through the foundation. So I am really sorry that Senator Gibson feels the way she does, but we heard these same rumors that everybody else heard. I told my team to shut them down. I told my team not to share them. They didn't. I have absolutely no control over what a handful of people say on social media. And look, I know how much it hurts to lose an election. I've done that. You put your heart and soul into it. I get it. At the end of the day, I'm so sorry that she had the perception that it was my folks. But it, Lord knows, I wish I had the ability to shut down what people say on social media. That would be wonderful. But I don't have that ability. People are going to say what they're going to say. I'm going to keep on running a positive campaign and do what I can to unify the city because I believe that, you know, we got to solve these problems together. And I hope at some point she and I can have a conversation. I did leave her a message on election night thanking her for her service. I do thank her for her service. And I'm very hopeful that we can move on at least to have a conversation about the issues in this campaign. But certainly, Nikisha, never had any expectation for anybody to carry my water. I'm out here doing the work, and I'll continue to do that in every way that I possibly can. But no disrespect at all meant to Senator Gibson.
Okay. Thank you for that. And let me ask you while we have you on the line. In May, this is going to come down to a turnout battle between you and your opponent. Turnout often falls off in a runoff. What is your plan to drive turnout in this race? And by the way, as I say every time, we've invited Daniel Davis to appear on this program to discuss his campaign as well.
Well, actually, it's not true that turnout drops off in the generals. I mean, that's generally not true. It's happened a couple of times, but normally turnout is better. That's what our numbers have shown. But we certainly have to do our part in that. Yeah, we need to do a better job of turning out the precincts that we need to turn out. But that was you know, there were, we've looked at some of the numbers. I don't believe that in all the areas that AG was talking about, we saw poor turnout. In the areas where we spent the most time, we actually saw some pretty good turnout. So I know we got to do a better job. We've got to turn out more people. We've got to get more people connected. I think if there was anything I was most disconcerted about election night is I sure did not expect that turnout would be only 25%. I don't understand people not engaging in the civic process that will determine their basically their lives in their own city. But I have to do my part in getting that out. And so we will. That's number one is to get the turnout up.
Let me ask you about another issue that came up in the primary and may come up again. Leanna Cumber took some shots at Daniel Davis, saying he was involved in the failed effort to privatize JEA. The other week on this show, City Councilmember Randy DeFore went on the record and said Davis was used as a pass-through in his role as CEO of the Jacksonville City Council to fund consultant meetings and other privatization efforts that would otherwise be subject to Florida Sunshine Laws. Last night, City Councilman Matt Carlucci sent out an email saying that JEA is at risk of being privatized again due to a bill moving in Tallahassee. This bill is championed by Jacksonville Republican State Rep. Wyman Duggan, who has lobbied for the company that tried to buy JEA and privatize it. And so I want to ask you, do you plan to make this a major campaign issue against your opponent, since the voters of Jacksonville have made it very clear they are opposed to selling off JEA?
Well, look, you and I had this discussion the morning after the election when I called in. You know, Daniel Davis, all those things that Randy DeFore said, those things are true. Those are documented things. Those are facts. They're not smears that he did do that. And I think that it would be ridiculous for anyone to argue that at one point at least, he played a role in trying to privatize the JEA. And if we've watched over and over again as local rule has evaporated from our city with really very little, if any, pushback from the mayor's office and from this council. And I expect that if Daniel Davis were to get into office, you would still not see pushback against this effort to take away our local rule. What does that mean? That means we could very well lose the JEA. So I think that it's going to be an issue that he's going to have to answer to. Certainly I'll make it an issue. I have never said in this campaign that I would not talk about the important issues that separate us and that things where I think he has fallen short. What I said was, I'm not going to make stuff up and lie about people. That's really all I've said. I'm not going to run a negative campaign, but I certainly will talk issues.
All right. Donna Deegan, thanks for calling in.
You bet.
And again, we have an open invitation to Daniel Davis and hope to have him on before May 16th, which is the election day. Part duh. Joe McClain.
Well, speaking as to what will drive turnout, speaking as to how this runoff is going to go as opposed to the, you know, primary, I'm just using that word. I was sort of doing the routine job of what local news reporters do on election night in the early afternoon, where we go to polling places and we talk to voters as they're exiting and having just voted, asking them what issues were really driving them to the polls. So I was up on the north side. I was at a precinct that across from Biscayne Elementary School, like 9 out of 10 people who are walking in there were Black citizens of Jacksonville. And as I was asking them when they were coming out, what were the issues mainly, you know, causing you to come out and vote? What were you thinking about when you were marking your ballot? And they were mainly, most people didn't really have any specific policy issues. Some people mentioned, yeah, crime, we want to get the crime down. Other people meant there's this development. Other people said there's this development happening in my neighborhood that I don't really like. I want to see if, you know, mm-hmm. there can be some policy to get it moved or you know. Most people, though, were really talking about the vibe of the city, the mood, the tone of the city and its leadership, and not really specifically saying anything that they want their specific candidate to do, more who that person represents and the message that they're kind of selling. So I think how these two candidates ultimately define themselves in these finishing weeks, define what the tone of their leadership is going to be, what their real philosophy is going to be, selling that and communicating that, I think, is going to be the most potent thing to get people saying, okay, I want to actually go and mark a ballot for this person. And I think from here on out, it's going to be more important to build your own support rather than attempting to tear the other person's down. But again, that's just a amateur political analyst over here.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, we've seen it over and over again. Negative campaigning does work. Deegan is saying she's going to run a positive campaign. We'll see how it goes. But I want to, first of all, send condolences to Leanna Cumber, who we mentioned mm-hmm. a minute ago. Her mother passed away this week. So a tough week for Cumber, losing in the primary for mayor and then losing her mother. So our condolences to her. At the same time, the special city council committee looking into her involvement in the failed attempt to sell JEA is referring its findings to the Ethics Commission. Cumber has called the whole thing a weaponization of City Hall meant to harm her and help Daniel Davis. You know, I just wanted to make mention of that briefly since we were talking about JEA.
Anybody who was exposed, involved with, or connected to JEA in any way is not going to get away from the investigations, federal, state, local, or otherwise. So, you know, Daniel Davis slung mud at Leanna Cumber to get her involved, and she slung it right back, and I'm sure his time will come. So, I mean, that just goes to show that JEA and the quest to privatize it was so toxic that nobody involved is going to be left untouched. And so whoever's not involved yet, get ready.
And it was the thing about JEA is every single time its CEO, Jay Stowe, speaks in public, the first thing he says is JEA is not for sale.
Yeah. AG, I don't want to leave AG out.
Nobody asked for it.
He's on Zoom. AG Gankarski, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you know, regarding the JEA attacks, yeah, I mean, I agree they're going to play in this race, and this is territory Deegan can exploit for sure. And I don't expect Cumber to play a role in politics in the next few weeks. I mean, my mom died 4 years ago during the mayoral race, and I know after that I was not thinking about politics very much. So I can't imagine what she's going through. But this is also something that, you know, it's going to seem like a remote issue to people. I mean, the effort to privatize JEA, last effort at least, was a few years ago. So this is not one that is going to win an election for Donna Deegan. It's not one that's going to overturn the, you know, R+4 turnout that we saw in the first election. These are real considerations that have to be in play. It's like, yeah, the JEA issue matters, but it's part of nutritious breakfast. It's not the whole thing.
Linda in Mandarin. Hi, Linda. Thanks for holding.
Hey, guys. I just want to know, I appreciate these Friday roundups. I just referred it to friends to listen at 8 o'clock, but they can't hear it this morning. But I
it replays at 8 o'clock at night. Yeah, thank you. Thanks for promoting us.
Newsletter. I'm plugging you all the time, and I get your newsletter. But sometimes there's commentary, and sometimes there's reporting. And I think it's really important in this environment when people are just picking up certain information from you guys or from somewhere to figure out what's going on, that we delineate. So if, I mean, and I'm just going to be frank, and Linda, if the piece that was Audrey Gibson that somebody sent me last night, and there are quotes that weren't corroborated or fact-checked, then we just need to say, this is an essay. Because that's not reporting if I don't have both sides. And I just want to say, you guys are part of our eyes and ears. But if some things you're saying, your reporters, if it's your, you know, if you're being a pundit, you're a pundit. But the pundancy and reporting are different. And sometimes we need to let the public know when you're discerning that information that this is based on what you read and talked to. This is punditry on what you think is going to happen, but you haven't confirmed it with everybody to give me that is factual reporting. And that's all I have to say for today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for that. All right, folks, I know everyone wants to keep talking about the mayor's race, but we need to talk about some other news. A Senate panel has approved a bill sponsored by Jacksonville Republican Clay Yarbrough that could revoke the licenses of businesses that admit children to what they call adult live performances. Under the measure, the state would revoke the license of any lodging or food service establishment, and they could issue fines The bill doesn't specifically use the word drag, although opponents say drag clubs, like, say, Hamburger Mary's, a popular local club, are a main target. Now, to my knowledge, kids don't go to those shows to begin with, Will Brown. So what's this about?
That is also to my knowledge. Though I do remember one time, I think there was a LGBTQ event at Hamburger Mary's a few years ago, and my wife took my son as a way of saying, we're not tolerating this in our community of attacks against the LGBTQ community. So are there people, are there possibilities that children may be in there? Yes, but their parents are the ones who are taking them. So if their parents are the ones who are thinking that this is acceptable, then we should let parents be parents, because is that not what we're asking for in other areas of our civic discussion right now? Let parents decide? So either we let parents decide or we don't.
549-2937. You know, Joe McClain, these bills are getting a lot of attention. Bills dealing with drag shows, the LGBT community, banning the teaching of AP African American studies, which is upsetting to many people, lots of other things. One textbook that we saw in Duval County removed any reference of race to the story of Rosa Parks, for goodness sake. You know, at the same time that all of these measures are moving in Tallahassee, we've become one of the most unaffordable states in the country in terms of housing costs. There's a property insurance crisis, which is still ongoing, and other kitchen table issues that, frankly, a lot of voters say they'd like to see more attention paid to.
I do a lot of education stories for WJXT, News for Jax, and in that, I am talking to parents a lot. I'm talking to families in local schools and hearing from them, and particularly about a lot of these policies that, like, for instance, the library book review, the mass review requirement, this crackdown on drag performances. None of these, from what I've heard from people, are solving any existing problem. I haven't heard from anybody that their kid was mentally screwed up from going to a drag performance or reading a book that they got in school that now the kid is emotionally distressed and so what I've heard from these folks that I've talked to is that these aren't solving any problems. They appear to be addressing people's visceral fears, but I haven't seen any measurable way that these types of policies help at all solve any existing problems. And that's, I'm honestly, like, been trying to ask folks, what is the harm? And there's no requirement that people attend any drag performance. If that were the case, that'd be something that I probably support repealing. I don't want to be forced to go to anything that I don't want to go to. But this isn't that. This is, you know, legislating against a performance art or library books for a problem. Where was this problem? Was there an epidemic of kids checking out dirty books from school and now because I just haven't seen it in all my reporting.
Yeah, but by the way, the governor is also expanding the Parental Rights in Education Act, what critics call the Don't Say Gay Law, where any discussion of gender identity issues is not allowed in K through third grade. That is now being extended to all grades. Nikisha Williams.
You know what?
This is gonna be good.
This drag show bill, to me, it's like if the Democrats had control and say, you know, we want to ban kids from going to NASCAR or from to country music shows because there's going to be they might see the Confederate flag, right? There would be outrage about that. No, anybody who's going to a drag show or wants to see that kind of entertainment is going on purpose. And if they're taking their children, they either want to expose them to the culture or they are trying to show their support if their children identifies as LGBTQ+. If you're going to expand the Don't Say Gay bill to high school, it's not going to work. They already know what it is. My son is 8. He's heard so much about gay people and this, that, and the third that instead of asking me about it, he Googled it on YouTube and spelled it wrong because he's 8 and looked up what does gay mean. And when I looked at the iPad to find out, to just see what he was doing, I said, son, did you look this up? He said, yes. I said, why didn't you ask me? I was afraid. This type of censorship does not give parents more rights or more choice. It does not give children the tools that they need to be a whole human in this society. Gay people, I'm sorry, folks, have always existed.
Mm-hmm.
They've always been here. Those who have identified as two spirits, as Indigenous people say, have always existed.
Non-binary
people. Folks have always existed. They've always been here, and they've never been a detriment to your way of life. You just think that they are because someone is telling you that and has used the bully pulpit to force that down your throats and think that, oh, by harming and disenfranchising these communities that you don't like, it gives you more power. It doesn't. It absolutely doesn't.
And as another parent of an 8-year-old, you know, this idea of, oh, well, children shouldn't be exposed to some of these things. My son has very, very long hair. I mean, it's his... follicle role models are Colin Kaepernick and Lenny Kravitz. but more than one classmate has said, well, are you a girl? And he's like, no, I'm a boy. And this is second grade children saying this. But would his teacher step in? Can she step in? Yeah. And so the idea, like, kids know a lot more than we give them credit for. And so in my opinion, to give the credit to the caller earlier, in my opinion, we should be fostering ways for kids to learn more, not learn less.
AG Gankarski, this drag measure is of a piece with a lot of other measures, some of which are being sponsored by members of the Jacksonville delegation in Tallahassee.
Specifically Yarborough.
Right.
I mean, you know, Clay Yarborough actually had a bill that expanded parental rights in education legislation to 9th grade. His bill also would ban use of pronouns other than the biological pronouns you're assigned at birth. It would make sex ed discussions heterosexualified, basically, you know, revolving around, you know, women and men and their biological purposes. But this is of a piece with Clay Yarborough historically. I want to make sure I'm doing reporting here, not punditry. The caller said, but you know, when Yarborough's on the city council, he's one of the most conservative members of the council. He had that highly publicized blow up over the mocha portrait of a pregnant woman nursing or whatever it was.
I believe he tried to have it labeled pornography.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, he went to the House, and you know, 6 years in the House, he kind of kept his social conservatism on the back burner. He didn't file a lot of legislation like this. A lot of technical bills, very boring legislation. Fast forward now to the Senate, and he definitely is taking up a lot of this social conservative movement. And what's interesting is he was not DeSantis' first choice for that Senate seat. DeSantis, he would have preferred perhaps Cord Byrd or Jason Fisher. He was not happy at the time that Senate leadership put their thumb down and said, we want Yarborough. That's really what cleared that Senate race, got Jason Fisher in the property appraiser, got Cord Byrd, ultimately in the Secretary of State. But, yeah, I mean, Clay Yarborough is definitely carrying a lot of this legislation. I expect more of it. And this is part of DeSantis' larger plan to have something to run on in 2024. You know, he's trying to establish himself as the most conservative governor. That includes his play to the social conservatives that, by and large, have been faithful to Donald Trump in a way that nobody would have expected, given that Donald Trump is basically a New York liberal who became a Republican over a decade ago. So it's an interesting play for Yarborough. There's not a lot of resistance for this or anything that's happening in Tallahassee. This is one where, as the Sands puts it, he's putting wins on the board, and he calls himself a winner in these interviews. And this is the kind of thing he's referring to.
Now, speaking of the Florida Senate, I want to quickly mention they have given final approval to bills that would significantly expand school vouchers and also protect business and insurance companies from lawsuits. Now, the voucher bill would make all Florida students eligible for vouchers and set up education savings accounts. Republicans say this is simply about expanding school choice. Opponents, including a Democrat, Tracy Davis of Jacksonville, say this will only chip away at funding for traditional public schools. Joe McClain.
It makes it available to all students in Florida. And the real key part that a lot of people have objection is ... regardless of household income. And I think the biggest voices of opposition to this are really pointing to the fact that this is, again, more taxpayer money that is going to private schools that have very, very little, if any, public oversight by our elected school board, by any representative of the public. These schools get to choose who they admit and who they reject. And so people really just see it as a further move towards privatization of education, privatization and the disintegration of public education. That being said, I mean, I am the parent of 0 8-year-olds, zero children. But I have to say, like, the real catch-22 here in this whole discussion is education. If I'm a parent, I'm seeing it as sort of a zero-sum game. I want to advocate for my child. Like, if I'm just speaking as not a parent, but, like, if I'm putting myself in those shoes, I want to advocate for my child. And if I think my child has an opportunity to get ahead, I'm going to take it. So, I mean, where do we want to have our education funding and our resources go? Do we want to make it sacrifice individual advancement to maintain the public education and the opportunity and well-funded public schools for everybody? It's a tough dilemma right now, particularly with how public schools are operating now. They're severely underfunded, and yes.
All right. With all of that said, we've got a few minutes left, so we'll go around the horn and talk about stories that might have escaped your attention this week. Yes, it's our lightning round. I'll start. A listener emails, please mention there's another bill moving in Tallahassee that would take away local control from the city council on the issue of removing monuments to the Confederacy. That's a bill that would make it illegal in Florida to take down Confederate statues. That is moving as well. Nikisha Williams.
I'm going to stay with the community events and shout out the Big Gay Party Volume 2 happening tonight at the Glass Factory, since we were just talking about the banning of drag shows. Make sure you go in case it might be the last one you can see. It's tonight at the Glass Factory.
A.G. Gankarski.
Yeah, I want to look back to Tuesday's election. Eric Parker, the Libertarian ring against Terrence Freeman, had the best turnout, 35% of any Libertarian or third-party candidate in Jacksonville history. What does that mean for Libertarians going forward? I don't know, but it's a big deal for Libertarians. Their strategy for decades has been, we want more local offices. This proves that at least without a Democrat in the field, they can get some votes.
Thanks for that. Will Brown.
This afternoon, the University of Miami women's basketball team will play in the Sweet 16 for the first time in 31 years. Their starting guard, Jasmine Roberts, is a Duval girl who went to Bishop Kenny High School. I'm looking forward to see if she can help the Hurricanes get to the Elite Eight for the first time ever.
Little Duval!
Hey.
Joe McClain. Did I do it wrong?
Yeah, no, you're right.
Joe McClain.
Ending on a more, not exactly a optimistic note, but this is something that's happening as we speak. A judge in St. John's County they're going through the final sentencing hearing for Aiden Fucci, the teen who murdered Tristan Bailey in St. John's County. Remember that. That sentencing is expected to be handed down today.
Okay. That's all great stuff. Also, lots more about the elections at JaxToday.org and WJCTNews.org. And make sure to tune in today at noon for the Florida Roundup. Another bill in Tallahassee would make it banned for elementary school girls to talk about their periods at school. What's that about? We'll take a closer look. Also on the Florida Roundup today at noon, there's a fungus among us. There's a fungus killing lots of Floridians, as if there aren't enough other things in the state trying to kill us. We will explain what's going on with that medical situation. And then Saturday at 4, join Dr. Joe Servin of Mayo Clinic for our show, What's Health Got to Do with It? Staff members share their favorite healthcare books for spring and more on What's Health Got to Do with It. That's Saturday at 4 o'clock. And I want to thank all four of you for being here. As always, thank you, Nikisha Williams, Will Brown, Joe McClain, and A.G. Gankarski. And have a great weekend.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
All right, a quick break, but when we come back, he's one of the most iconic rock and roll photographers around. We'll speak with Mark Weiss about some of his most famous photos of your favorite rock stars. We'll tell you all about his art and where you can see this exhibit this weekend right here in town. We will be right back.
Join me, Dr. Joe Servin, for What's Health Got to Do with It, Saturdays at 4 p.m. and Sundays at 9 p.m. on WJZT News 89.9, sponsored in part by Eli Lilly, American Brain Foundation, Epilepsy Foundation, and Norellis.
For the best music from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, tune in to 89.9 HD3, the WJZT app, or jacksmusic.org. We've got your music on Anthology on 89.9 HD3.
Season of the HBO series Succession begins Sunday. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to our interviews with Brian Cox, who plays Logan Roy, the patriarch in a family-owned business empire, Kieran Culkin, who plays Roman, the immature, jokey son, and Matthew McFadyen, who plays the put-upon son-in-law Tom Wamsgans. Join us
today at 1 on WJCT News 89.9.
Wild weather leaves thousands without power in California. Outside a courtroom in Manhattan, reporters waited out, and after a bumpy ride for banks, the Fed chair finds himself again walking a tightrope.
We have to bring inflation down to 2%, you know, and to get back to where we were for a quarter of a century.
We get to the biggest stories of the week on the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. The iconic music photographer Mark Weiss, also known as Weiss Guy, will be in town this weekend to meet his fans and talk about some of his classic photos. Weiss has also published several books, including his bestseller, The Decade That Rocks. Mark Weiss will be at Gallery 725 from 6 to 8 tomorrow night and again from 1 to 4 on Sunday. Our producer, Brendan Rivers, spoke with him last week about his upcoming show. Let's take a listen.
Can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and you how you got into music photography?
Well, I started taking pictures when in 1974, when I first shot Elton John, I kind of stuck my camera in. And then a couple years later, I started selling them in front of the concerts and out of my high school locker for $1 a piece. Then I got arrested at a Kiss concert in 1977 and went to jail overnight. And I didn't want to do that anymore, so I went to Circus Magazine, which is a big rock magazine at the time, and I met the art director and the publisher of the magazine, and they kind of took a liking to me, and 6 months later, they published my first picture, which is a centerfold of Steven Tyler of Aerosmith, And then shortly after that, I became like a main contributor doing features and covers.
Mm-hmm. And what bands and musicians have you photographed that our listeners might be familiar with?
Bon Jovi. I did the Slippery and Wet album cover. I did the Stay Hungry Twisted Sister cover with Dee Snider holding the bone. I did a lot of Guns N' Roses, Van Halen, and Aerosmith. And pretty much any band you could think of in the 80s. And then also in the 70s, when I first started, I shot Peter Frampton. I did a photo shoot with him at his home for his publicity photographs in 1979. That was one of my first photo shoots with a rock star. I was still a teenager. And then I also did shoots with bands like the Stones. Not photo shoots, but, you know, I shot them live for, you know, almost every tour from since 78. And David Bowie, Tom Petty, I did a shoot with him in 1985 at his recording studio, which is actually at the gallery event. And, you know, pretty much almost anyone in the 80s I've shot, whether it's rock and even pop. You know, same as Madonna, when she did her first walk-on interview on MTV with Mark Goodman, I was there to take trade photos, but I pulled it to the side and got a couple portraits. That's also going to be at the Gallery 725 this weekend.
And do you have like an individual photo that you're most proud of?
I would say my most proud moment was early in my career. It was 1981. It was my first assignment doing a cover for Circus of Ozzy Osbourne. And we did this shoot. It was supposed to be most athletic. It was supposed to be a small black and white photo in this high school yearbook theme photo pictorial. And Ozzy used to jump around a lot. And so we dubbed him Most Athletic. So I figured I'd bring some boxing gloves there, and he picked up a pink tutu, and there were some red cowboy boots in the corner of the room that I said, try those on. And next thing you know, we have this picture of Ozzy in a pink tutu with boxing gloves and red cowboy boots and jumping around having fun, and they used it for the cover of the magazine.
So yeah, tell us a little bit about what's going on this weekend and what you're doing at Gallery 725.
Yeah, well, you know, they requested to do a gallery show, and I was, you know, I always love going to different cities and setting up and having each one unique. So I sent them over to my book, The Decade That Rocked, and I said, you know, page through the book and mark the ones you like that you want to represent that you think your clients would like and would want to hang up in their homes, because that's what we're doing. We're making prints and people are coming by and hopefully taking a couple home. The prints there are going to be 16 by 20s. However, the idea is to pick the print and then, find the size you like, and then they would order it and then frame it, and then we make the special order, and then I'll sign it on the bottom, of course. So, yeah, there's quite a bit of photographs hanging on the walls, along with a special... for a first-time event that one of my, this girl named Mikkel Pelicone, who's actually my girlfriend, will be embellishing one of my photographs live at the event on Saturday, I believe, 6 to 8. And she is going to just, you know, do it on canvas. So they printed it over there at Gallery 725, a very large print on canvas. And she's going to, you know, give it a little bit of a little creative embellishment. And the ones that she already embellished was a Prince photograph, Debbie Harry from Blondie, Bruce Springsteen from the Tunnel of Love tour, as well as a John Bon Jovi. Those are already completed. And so she's going to do a live embellishment at some point during the evening.
Now, that was our own Brendan Rivers speaking with music photographer Mark Weiss, who will be at Gallery 725 tomorrow night from 6 to 8 p.m. And Sunday afternoon from 1 to 4 p.m. You can meet Weiss, see some of his work. If you love 80s rock, you won't want to miss this. For more info, head over to gallery725.com. And make sure to join me and my co-host Danny Rivero today at noon for the Florida Roundup, our live statewide call-in show where we round up the biggest stories from across the state of Florida. That is the Florida Roundup today at noon. And thank you so much for listening. Thanks also to our team, executive producer David Luckin, senior producer Heather Schatz, producer Brendan Rivers, director Isabella Da Silva, producer Bridget O'Brien, and technical help from Morning Edition host Michelle Corum. Our theme music, our new theme, composed and performed by Club de Belugas. Drop us an email anytime at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Melissa Ross. This is WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.